So it's always a great honor to be asked to give a colloquium at one of the world's great research universities, and I'm just so flattered to have the opportunity to be here and to speak with you. I think it was implicit from what John said that I'm American, but I am now very, very Canadian, and I think John forgot to point out that Arthur Shallow was Canadian. So something that make it even a little bit nicer that I got the Shallow Award. Okay, so the title today is Quantum Nonlinear Optics. Nonlinear Optics Meets the Quantum World. So I'm trying to capture the thought that nonlinear optics historically was a very classical field, and that now the field is evolving into a field of importance for quantum information science. So here's another way of expressing the thought. Nonlinear optics is a superb platform from which to explore new physical processes and to develop applications in photonics. In other words, we are right at the borderline between physics and applied physics and engineering. And I personally find that a very, very attractive position to be in. Here's a brief perspective of the talk, introduction to nonlinear optics. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I'll give some introductory materials. And then, well, talk about four projects that I have going on. This is to give you a flavor of what it is about nonlinear optics that I think is so very exciting. So, first of all, how do we understand nonlinear optics? Well, here is the simplest way to understand it. Professor Syke pointed out I've written a textbook on nonlinear optics. I've taken the entire 500-page book and compressed it into one slide here. If you understand this, you can say, oh, everything else is an issue of detail. Okay, so the not the only way, but the standard formulation of nonlinear optics is to express P, that's the dipole per unit volume, D is equal to epsilon 0 E plus P. It's the P that appears right in Maxwell's equations. We take P and expand it in a power series in the electric field amplitude of your laser field. Each one of these terms actually describes distinct physical processes. First term, obviously, is linear optics. P is proportional to E. For example, it describes how lenses work. Second term is quadratic processes. For example, how second harmonic generation works. In second harmonic generation, a laser beam of frequency omega enters a nonlinear crystal. Light leaves at frequency 2 omega. And I'm very happy to announce that this green light that you see here is from the process of second harmonic generation. There is not a green laser inside of a laser pointer. It's a neodymium laser operated at 1.06 microns, which is frequency doubled up to the green light that we see. Next term in the power series expansion actually describes many different processes. One of them could be third harmonic generation. Light at frequency omega turns into light at frequency 3 omega. It can describe generalized four-wave mixing processes. Three waves excite a material, and a new wave is generated. But perhaps most significantly, the nonlinear coefficient chi3 describes the coefficient that is usually called N2. N2 is the coefficient describing how the refractive index, N, changes with the intensity of a laser field. So this is crucially important for the field of photonics. You would want one laser field to be able to control another laser field. So if one laser field can change the refractive index in a material, that is the basic means by which we can do optical switching and optical control. Let me give you an example of this. This is a real experiment that I did with a very long time ago. I was a very young child, figuratively. when this was taken. This was almost my first, well, these were my first set of graduate students when I joined the faculty at Rochester. So we take a nonlinear material, which actually we made ourselves, that's a different story, and we take two laser beams. They intercept inside the nonlinear material, so they form an interference pattern. And because the material is nonlinear, you have a spatial variation of the refractive index that has exactly the same form. Then each of the laser beams diffracts from this, I'll call it a grating now, diffracts from the grating, creating two additional output beams. So here, to your very eyes, you can see the essence of nonlinear optics. One laser beam scatters off another laser beam to create light in a new direction. This is called light-by-light scattering. It's been predicted that this can happen in the electromagnetic vacuum, but the laser intensities required are enormous. I forget now, 10 to the 25th watts per square centimeter or something of that order. But all you have to do is put a nonlinear optical material there, and this process becomes a very, very strong process, compelling process. You can just see it in the laboratory. So I can call this traditional nonlinear optics. More recently, we have something that I call intense field and attosecond physics. Well, let's see, Paul Corkum, Ferenc Krauss are two of the dominant figures in this field. Well, I talked about second harmonic generation and third harmonic generation, but there's a process called high harmonic generation. In this data here, I show harmonics up to the 31st order, but now they've gone up to like 101st order. The way we understand this is a very simple model proposed by Paul Corkum, who is my colleague in Ottawa. So here is an electron that is almost, the laser field is so strong that the laser field has almost ionized the electron. The electron is being pulled away from the atomic core. Once every optical cycle, it comes slamming into the core, emitting a brief burst of radiation. Well, if you have a picket fence in the time domain, that turns into a picket fence in the frequency domain. So that's why we have high harmonic generation. Also, if you calculate the duration of this pulse, it turns out to be of the order of attoseconds. So this is the means by which people create attosecond pulses. It's a nonlinear optical effect, extreme nonlinear optical effect. Why do we care about high harmonic generation? Well, this is an alternative way of forming X-rays for medical imaging, as just one example of why people care so much about high harmonic generation. But now, what about quantum nonlinear optics? So why am I interested in this? Well, because I want to explore the relation between traditional nonlinear optics and phenomena in quantum information science. Quantum information science, well, the goal everyone has in mind is to build a quantum computer. But we're taking now small steps along the way in building the optical computer. And many processes in quantum information rely on nonlinear optical interactions. And let me give you a couple of examples. First of all, parametric downconversion is a source of entangled photons. So let's say you take a laser beam, you excite a crystal with this second order nonlinear optical response. Every once in a while, a pump photon from the laser splits into two other photons, which for historical reasons are called the signal and the idler photon. Now, it turns out that, well, and this process also conserves momentum in the way shown here. Well, it turns out that the signal and the idler photon are entangled simultaneously, in general, in many degrees of freedom. And these are useful for fundamental tests of quantum mechanics and also quantum technologies such as quantum teleportation. What do I mean by entanglement in this context? Well, let's just look at this picture here. we assume we know the pump frequency, if I measure the signal frequency, you can immediately deduce the idler frequency. That's obvious. But if you measure the exact moment of time, the instant of time at which this signal photon is created, it turns out that the idler photon is created exactly at that same instant of time. Why do we call it entangled? Well, if I measure the energy of this photon, I lose information about the timing of this photon. But if I measure the timing of this photon, I lose information about the energy of this photon. I can measure both of them to high accuracy in the time domain. I can measure both of them to high accuracy in the frequency domain, but I have to choose one or the other. And that's the essence of entanglement, at least if we want to be brief about it. Now, here's an experiment that I did with my students a number of years ago. I guess the background here is we're asking how much information can you impress onto a single photon? If you don't think very deeply, you say, one photon, one bit of information. But that's wrong. You can impress more information on a single photon than one bit. Here's an example, sort of artificial, but we have four objects, A, B, C, and D, and we want to determine which object we have with a single photon. So here's what we do. I just unfolded the diagram from the last page so that one of the entangled photons is going this way, the other entangled photon is going that way. Here we have what I'll call a multiplexed hologram. We have the hologram of this pattern superimposed with the hologram of this pattern and this and this. So what goes on here? If the photon passes through this object, this detector will go click. That means that the transverse structure of this photon has taken on the aperture that it goes through. But the photons are entangled. That means that its partner photon picks up the same transverse structure, diffracts off the hologram, and goes into the proper output port. And here, I think we overdid this, putting the microphone high enough so that you could hear me. So here's the results. If it worked perfectly, we would get counts on the diagonal, right? If we have object A, detector A clicks. If we have object B, detector B clicks. We have very, very little crosstalk showing that this protocol works. You can discriminate among these objects with a single photon measurement. So that's the introduction. These are some topics I've been working on historically. And I sure hope I'm not repeating myself. I get invited to Toronto often, but maybe nothing as distinguished as the colloquium. So if you've heard this before, it was certainly not in the context of this series. Okay, so I want to talk about slow light. So what do I mean by slow light? Well, this is something that is still very exciting and exotic. I'm part of a community that knows how to control the group velocity of light. We can make light go slow, maybe a million times slower than the speed of light in vacuum. We can make it go fast. The group velocity is greater than c. Don't worry, I said the group velocity, not the information velocity. And we can even make it go backwards, which is a phenomenon in which the phase fronts are progressing this way, but the peak of the pulse is progressing that way. And let's see an example of how we might do this. So if you have an absorption line in some material system, you will always have a refractive index distribution that looks like this. And now the prescription is take the derivative of this and add it to itself. Well, almost always the second term dominates the first. So you take the derivative and you get this. And you see that you get fast light at line center, slow light in the wings of the line. If you have a gain resonance, this curve flips top to bottom. You have slow light here, fast light in the wings of the line. So I'm part of a community. We're like stage magicians. We have learned all of the tricks to manipulate the group velocity of light. So here's an experiment that we did. a number of people, Garrett McCumber, Ray Chow, thesis advisor of Professor Steinberg, point out this very exotic effect that if a pulse of light falls onto a material in which the group index is negative, here's what's going to happen. As the pulse approaches, suddenly, seemingly out of nothing, a pulse appears at the exit face, splits into two, one going backwards, one going forwards. Eventually, these two pulses annihilate, leaving only a single pulse that emerges sooner than if the original pulse had traveled through an equal volume of vacuum. Now, you don't have to believe me. You don't have to believe Professor Chow. Go home and try it tonight. Do Mathematica, do MATLAB. Use your simplest differential equation solver. Propagate a pulse of light through a material with a negative group index, and you're going to see this. Now, when I see a prediction that's this counterintuitive, that's when I know I'm a real experimentalist. So my students say, hey, we got to do this. We got to do the experiment. So we did it. And it's not quite as clear here, but you can see that the pulse splits into two. Here, a backward-going pulse annihilates with this pulse at the input of the crystal. Why is the experiment not as nice as the theory? Well, first, they never are. But secondly, when you do theory, you can turn off all the competing effects. There's something called group velocity dispersion, for those of you who do photonics. So in my computer code, I said, turn off all competing effects. Regrettably, in the laboratory, when I said, set up, turn off all competing effects, it didn't listen to me. So there's a lot of broadening that you see here. Okay, that was for fun. Now, this is more recent work involving slow light, and I want to develop a miniaturized chip scale spectrometer. And I guess at one level, I want to beat the 1 over L resolution limit from spectrometers. And Professor Towns always told me, if there's one place in the world that understands spectroscopy, it's the University of Toronto. You know, Archala was his brother-in-law, and Archala was from here. So maybe this came to me from Toronto by this circuitous route. So in a Fourier transform spectrometer, you move the mirror by an amount L. You calculate the limiting resolution. It's 1 over L. You take a grating spectrometer. You say, what is the path length difference between this ray and this ray? It's L. The limiting resolution is 1 over L. Question is, can I design a spectrometer that works better than this? And the answer is yes. There is a trick using slow light methods that will allow me to do this. And this is when I try to sell this to funding agencies like NASA, I say, if you want to put a spectrometer into space, would you want to put this into space, or this is our photonic crystal? Which one of these do you think would cost less to launch into space? They didn't give me the money. Okay, so how does this work? What is our trick? Let's take a standard Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Let's put a slow light material inside of it. And just to make the math even simpler, let's say that the only path length difference between this arm and this arm is the length of slow light material. And I want to determine, say, the wavelength of this tunable laser. So I look at the interference fringes that are cast at the output. These interference fringes depend on the phase difference of the light coming through this arm and the light coming through that arm. And I want to know how rapidly this changes with frequency. So I ask, what is d by d omega of the phase difference between the two arms, which is omega times n times l over c. And this is not a difficult derivative to calculate, but you find, to your surprise, unless you've done this many times before, that the group index pops out almost mysteriously. So common sense would tell me that a interferometer is sensitive to the phase index, the refractive index. But it turns out that if you ask the question this way, it's the group index that determines the resolution of a spectrometer. So we did this using slow light methods. I mean, this is a photonic crystal waveguide that we designed and fabricated ourselves. I will not go into all the physics of photonic crystal waveguides right here. Let me just remind you that any waveguide, when operated near the cutoff of the waveguide, gives rise to a very slow phase velocity. So we just build this photonic crystal waveguide, and we work right at the edge of the allowed band. And then we built this simple interferometer. Actually, we did this with fibers. The next step along the way is to put the whole thing on chip using nanofabrication. But we took our photonic crystal waveguide, we put it here, and we measure the interference pattern as a function of the wavelength of light. And you can see that as we approach the band edge, these fringes become closer and closer together. Here I blow this up. And if I take the resolution to be a quarter of a period of these oscillations, which is sort of the standard thing to do, I find that the resolution is 17 picometers or 2.1 gigahertz or 0.071 wave numbers. Sorry for those of you who like little MeV, but that's one I don't carry around in my head, I guess. 1.24, I know how to do it. But the waveguide here was only 1 millimeter long. So you might think that the limiting resolution should be 10 wave numbers, but we got something almost 100 times better. I believe that this is a profitable way to proceed, and we are continuing this work, trying to build the whole thing on chip. Now, but can we do useful things this way? This is a little bit of an aside. So let's say that you care about terrorism threats. I think we do care about terrorism threats. So can I build a spectrometer that will discriminate between acetylene and hydrogen cyanide? Of course, one of them is a deadly poison. And the spectra are not that dissimilar. So can we build a spectrometer that can do that? And, we did it. So here's the concept. We have a whole sequence of photonic crystal resonators. Each one has a different resonance frequency. We send the input light down a bus waveguide. And if wavelength lambda 1 is present, this crystal lights up, lambda 2, this one, this one, this one. We design the cavity. Very narrow resonance. We have a quality factor of about 70,000. And, here are the results here. When we measure HCN, we get something that agrees with the known spectrum but disagrees with that of acetylene and vice versa. So we have saved the free world from terrorism threats, from the hydrogen cyanide threat, at the very least. Truth in advertising. In this version, we did not have a sequence here. We had a single resonator. We ramped the temperature, thus ramping the resonance wavelength, which is actually not such a bad idea. I mean, a lot of people who do photonic devices, you put little heaters on their devices in order to tune the wavelength. So that's how we did it. Okay, now back to physics. Back to 19th century physics. Let me remind you that in 1859, Fizeau measured what we call longitudinal photon drag. He was testing out a prediction of Fresnel. So he built what we would call an interferometer. The word had not been invented, but obviously the concept had. Michelson invented the word interferometer. Americans are good at publicity, self-publicity. So Fizeau flowed water first in this direction, then he flows water in this direction. He wanted to ask, what is the velocity of light in a moving medium? Of course, in 1859, they knew what the velocity of light was in stationary media. So today, you would calculate this just by the relativistic addition of velocities. Here is the velocity of light in stationary water. Here's the velocity with which the water is moving. Here's the relativistic correction. You expand this in a power series, and this is the correction term, which today is called the Fresnel drag coefficient, because Fresnel believed in the luminiferous ether, and sort of a strange model that a moving object dragged the ether along with it, but with a slippage coefficient. It fit the data. So I asked myself, well, gee, this is a historic experiment. I wonder what would happen if we repeated this with a slow light material. I said, let's do this calculation. And I found out that Lorentz had stolen my idea 100 years earlier. 100 years earlier, Lorentz had the same idea. And he calculates the velocity of light in a moving medium, including the influence of the group velocity, and he gets this expression here, which you see depends on both the phase index and the group index. So we decided to do the experiment. We did it in a rubidium vapor, and at high temperature, there's two transmission features in the rubidium vapor. Everything else is just opaque. So first of all, just using time of flight, we measured the group index of rubidium around the D2 lines, and you see that we get group indices as large as a factor of 200 just by doing this. Then we said, well, let's now measure the velocity of light in a moving rubidium cell. So we get the rubidium cell, we get a very fast translation stage. A meter a second is actually pretty impressive when it's in your laboratory, especially when it's coming at you. You hope the students bolted it down properly. So the idea is we move the rubidium cell back and forth at about a meter per second. In the students' version of this, the fringes pop back and forth. That's nice, but you can imagine that the fringes are moving back and forth at the same, what's going on here? Are moving back and forth at the same time. From the amount that the fringes move, we deduce the overall phase shift, from which we induce the phase velocity of light. And here is the change in the phase velocity of light as a function of the temperature of the cell. The theory and the experiment agree well with one another. But what I find most intriguing is that we were moving the cell by 1 meter per second, but the change in phase velocity was 200 meters per second. So this suggests to me that maybe this is a good way of building a Doppler velocimeter. We've, in a sense, enhanced the Doppler effect by a factor of 200. And I forgot to say this. Go back to this equation here, set n equal to 1. You find that the group index, that the speed of light is enhanced by the velocity times the group index itself. That whole coefficient just turns into the group index. Okay, next, Möbius strips. For the Germans, Möbius. Okay, I said it right once. Now I'll call it Möbius. So Möbius strips of polarization. This is an experiment we did a couple of years ago. What's the motivation? Möbius strips are familiar geometrical structures, but their occurrence in nature is very rare. I mean, how often have you walked down the street and seen a snowflake in the form of a Möbius strip? I mean, it just doesn't happen. You start saying to yourself, are there situations in nature in which a Möbius structure just simply comes out? And we found one. This was a prediction of Isaac Freund. But the idea here is that using nano-optics, we can do this. We take a laser beam that is designed to be a vector beam. By vector beam, I mean that the polarization changes direction as a function of position on the beam. So it's not uniformly polarized. Different points on the cross-section of the beam have a different direction of polarization. We then focus that beam very tightly, and then we measure the polarization on a loop surrounding the axis of the beam. We plot the major axis of the polarization ellipse, and we find that after going once around the loop, it flips top to bottom. So it has the form of a Mobius strip. That was the prediction. So we needed to do the experiment. So here's an ordinary Mobius strip. Here is what we were trying to observe in the laboratory. And you see right here there's a discontinuity. We put blue on the bottom, green on the top, and here it's flipped. Of course, where you put that point is arbitrary. So how do we do it? Well, okay, the technology was developed by Gerd Leuchs and his group in Erlangen. This is just a very simple laser beam. This is just the donut mode of a laser beam. We take an 80 nanometer diameter metal nanoparticle. We raster scan it through the field distribution. We measure the scattered light in the forward direction and in the backward direction. We measure the phase of the light using interferometry. We measure the polarization of the light using polarizers. And we then calculate back. We do a reverse calculation to determine what polarization would have given us the structure that we observe. Here, this shows that it works. Somebody brought water for me? No, you didn't. No, you offered to bring water for me. Coffee will have to do. Okay, this shows that it works just for the donut beam that we showed here. But then, okay, so here's the actual experiment. It's a little bit complicated. We bring a laser beam in from the top, a Q plate. Q is the topological charge here. This is a liquid crystal device in which the topological charge, the amount by which the orientation of the liquid crystal molecules changes as you go around the loop, and the sign convention, the minus of the sign convention, it's 1/2. When you send light through a Q plate, you can change the form of the polarization as shown here. The other thing is that you can think of a Q plate as a wave plate with spatially varying orientation. So delta is the retardation in going through the wave plate. Delta equals zero means no wave plate at all. So if you send in left-hand circular light, Gaussian beam, you get out what you put in. If you put in a pi radian phase shift, it becomes a half wave plate, but with spatially varying orientation. And what you get out is right-hand circular light, but you've changed the transverse distribution of the beam. I need to tell you my notation. This is a Laguerre-Gauss mode, the fundamental Laguerre-Gauss mode. This is the Laguerre-Gauss mode 0 minus 1. For the actual experiment, we tuned the voltage halfway between, and we get this very unusual polarization distribution. And according to Isaac Freund, and we will not go through the calculation here, according to Isaac Freund, this is the one that gives us the Mobius strip of polarization. So here's the data. When we use this Q plate, we see that we get 3 half twists. And when we do this Q plate, we get a different one. So why did I even bother to tell you about this? Because it is so horribly cute. I couldn't help myself but to tell you about it. Is it important? Well, I think there are two takeaway messages here. The first is that focused laser beams can have significant structure on a sub-wavelength distance scale. And that's something that even 5 years ago, I'm not sure that I knew, that you would have thought that, there's structure. It's a Gaussian beam here, it's a Gaussian here, and it's just a little bit smaller. But there's this enormously rich structure in a tightly focused laser beam. And the second thing is that current technology is capable of creating these beams and measuring them. So I mean, we can measure the field distribution, the entire field distribution, with a 80 nanometer position resolution. I guess this will be the last topic. I wasn't expecting to get through this. I thought it was better to have fun with what I do. Okay, so huge optical nonlinearity from epsilon near zero materials. Let me motivate this work first. So general theme is new nonlinear materials for quantum technologies. Wouldn't we love to build a all optical switch that works at the single photon level, single photon in the control beam? Well, you'd need a much larger optical nonlinearity to do it. I'm thinking of a solid state system, not atomic vapors. But can we find a material that has a chi-3 value that is huge that would allow us to do single photon switching? And just earlier this year, I guess last year, we reported in Science Magazine such a material. And with a slight amount of exaggeration, we hope this is a game changer for the field of photonics. Well, let's ask ourselves, what makes a good nonlinear optical material? Well, you want N2 to be large, but you also want the overall change in refractive index to be large. Well, these are distinct concepts because linear scaling does not go on forever. So just the fact that N2 is large doesn't mean that delta N is necessarily large. So for our material, we found that N2, I won't give you numerical values, N2 is almost a million times larger than that of silica glass, and the maximum change in refractive index is about 3,000 times larger. Now, we did this in indium tin oxide. Isn't that weird? Indium tin oxide is perhaps the most common photonic material you could think of. Any smartphone has ITO. It's just that people had never measured N2 of ITO at the right wavelength before. So ITO is a degenerate semiconductor. That means it's so heavily doped that it's metal-like. It's very well described by the Drude formula. Note that the real part of epsilon vanishes at a frequency of the plasma frequency divided by the square root of epsilon infinity. This is called the epsilon near zero region. And if you have anything to do with photonics, you know the world has gone crazy. Over the past 5 years, everybody is excited about epsilon near zero. Just think about it. D is equal to epsilon E. If epsilon is zero, the D vector vanishes all the time. Everything you thought you understood about electromagnetism has to be rethought if you can think of situations in which the dielectric constant epsilon vanishes. And I've just quoted here some of the other people who've worked on this. So first thing we do is, well, we just characterize our sample and we find that it does indeed fit the Drude model, and that the epsilon near zero wavelength is 1.24 microns. So that's the wavelength at which we decided to work. What in the world does epsilon near zero have to do with nonlinear optics? Well, this is the canonical relation between N2 and chi-3. Note the real part of N0 there. John Seip and I derived that equation together about 15 years ago. Probably not the first people in the world, but I really wanted to make sure I had it right. So it's N0 times the real part of N0, which is a subtle point that you might overlook, assuming you care. But now, if you're doing epsilon near zero, if epsilon is very small, n naught is very small, that means that n2 will be very large. Let's think of chi 3 as the material parameter. That depends on the material. And that n2 is the material that is the what you measure in the laboratory. So if n naught is very small, n2 can be anomalously large. And so we, this is the calculation John and I did 15 years ago. You can look at it later. There's another effect, which is that the nonlinear optimal response is even larger at oblique incidence. So if we come in at an angle of incidence of theta, and we apply the standard boundary conditions of electromagnetism, we find that the field inside the material is related to the incident field by this result here. I will not insult your intelligence by deriving it. You see that as long as we are at non-normal incidence, and as long as epsilon is less than 1, the field inside will be larger than the field outside. So we did the experiment. Here is N2 plotted as a function of wavelength as we gradually increase the angle of incidence. By the way, this value here is the literature value. People had just never done the measurement at 1.24 microns. And indeed, why would they? If you weren't thinking exactly the way we were thinking, why would you choose some obscure wavelength and decide to measure N2 at that wavelength? Everything here is in the, was with powers up, or intensities up to 50 gigawatts per square centimeter. Once we go above 50 gigawatts per square centimeter, we find some very exotic behavior. For example, the surface reflectivity is decreasing. The nonlinear response is so large that we are changing the refractive index by so much that even the Fresnel reflection coefficient is modified. We measure the transmission, we measure the reflection, we deduce the absorption from energy conservation. We then do a propagation code, and we determine the real part of N and the imaginary part of N. And here is the data that shows that the change in refractive index can be as large as, well, some days it's 0.7, 0.8. It's right in between. Depends on how modest I'm trying to be. Okay, how fast is it? Well, we've measured the response time. And it's 360 femtoseconds, meaning that this will support modulation, switching speeds as large as 1.5 terahertz. This is fast, but not ultra fast, if you want to accept that that nomenclature. Or to say differently, this is not what we call an instantaneous response. It strongly suggests this is what's called a hot electron nonlinearity, that the laser beam heats up the conduction band electrons. This is not the lattice. So this hot electron nonlinearities have response times, of 360 femtoseconds, but they don't have sub-femtosecond response times. So I guess this is the conclusion slide for this part of the talk. I've said this already, but what are some of the physical effects that we can study using this new material? Well, wave guiding outside the weakly guiding regime, efficient all optical switching. There is no need for phase matching. K is M times omega over C. If N is zero, all waves have zero wave vector. So all interactions are automatically phase matched. Control of radiative processes. If you go through some simple calculations, you find that the Einstein A coefficient depends on the refractive index of the material in which the emitter is located. And if you go through calculations, you find that the Einstein B coefficient depends on the refractive index, and differently. So we think we can we can control radiative processes by making use of epsilon near zero materials. And that's something we're actively working on. And I guess from a more personal level, note that the usual power series description of nonlinear optics is not adequate for describing this material. I mean, if delta n becomes larger than n, then you have to rethink these perturbation expansions. This makes me so happy. I was born too late. Professor Towns and Professor Chow and Professor Bloombergen had written down the laws of nonlinear optics while I was still in high school. So I could not get in on formulating the laws in the first place, but now they need to be reformulated, and I can be part of this. So that makes me so happy. And I'm going to stop right here. I thank everyone for your attention. I think so. In concept, yes. What my slide said, which I didn't stress because who would, this is a very lossy material. It's a very lossy material, so the applications in quantum information science are maybe dubious, but there are other materials. So we chose ITO because we wanted to make it work. I mean, it was such a common material, annoyingly common to some people. You say, Bob, in 2016, you can't publish a paper on the optical properties of ITO in science. Everything that is there is to know about ITO has already been published. But that was the point. We really thought we could make this work. We never thought that this was the best material. We are right now looking for other materials in which the background loss will be smaller. We don't think that Kramers-Kronig will prevent that from happening. Just by the nature of what the degrees of freedom are here, we don't think that we necessarily have to have a huge amount of loss to be consistent with, because it's epsilon near zero point. It's not the intrinsic resonance of the material. So we're pushing very hard on that. I forget. No, I forget if we did that. I forget if we've done that. That is on the books for the next. We're going to do that. In fact, I said that Paul Corkum is one of the world's greatest experts on atto science. So our laser pulse wasn't really short enough to do accurate measurements. So starting February 15th, we're going to start those measurements in Paul Corkum's lab.
Any other questions? When can we start to see these slow light interferometers on the next generation of telescopes?
NASA has to fund it. That's a long story. The proposal got excellent scientific reviews, but some of the reviewers said that they weren't sure of the commercial applicability of our procedure. Well, yeah. I mean, who in the right mind would pay me to build a startup company? This was a U.S. project. It might just turn into a Canadian project, and I have money here to do it. So I will be working on it.
Actually, just to follow up to that, you probably know more about this than I do, but I seem to recall that there was a laser company that developed a laser that used slow light, that I think is on the market.
I remember that. Right, yeah, there is. I forget the details. And I was never convinced that it was hugely exciting or that it worked hugely better than you would have otherwise. Yeah, I remember that too. But for some reason, the details didn't stick, and that sort of tells you something already. Thank you.
Well, that was excellent.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.